Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to Dr. Nicola Mercer, who is the Medical Officer of Health for Wellington County, Dufferin County, and Guelph. Dr. Mercer is the highest-ranking public health official in our area and has been one of the leaders of the public health response to the pandemic. So it's pretty important for us to hear from her, especially as we enter this next key phase of the recovery. Our area has been under stage two of the reopening for nearly a month now, and people are eagerly looking for signs that we might be entering soon the final stage, stage three. Still, our position is precarious. We see what is happening in some places in the United States, and if there's one thing we can all agree on, it's that we do not want to re-enter lockdown in the event of more COVID-19 cases developing. So shall we listen to the good doctor's advice? The past, present, and future of the pandemic in our region is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, it seems like a million years ago, but Dr. Mercer appeared on this podcast barely 4 months ago at the beginning of March. At that time, a COVID-19 outbreak here in Canada, or even North America for that matter, seemed like a theoretical exercise, but it was just barely 2 weeks later that everything started shutting down. It makes you realize just how quickly COVID changed everything. We went from a regular day's routine of work, school, and errands to 3 months of lockdown and quarantine and empty streets. Getting from there to here has not been an easy journey, and there's been no roadmap to guide us along the way. In fact, our current state of the pandemic is still predicated on a lot of well-informed guesswork. Consider the debate over mandatory masks. Dr. Mercer's public health order made Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph the first area in Ontario to require masks indoors in public spaces, a move that was greeted with some confusion and anger at first in some quarters, but it's a move that has since been replicated in Toronto, Ottawa, Waterloo Region, Halton Hills, Brampton, and soon other places. Although there's still some unanswered questions, like how the disease spreads in terms of the size of droplets and the new warnings that the list of symptoms from COVID-19 is longer than we think, but through that, masks still seem to be the key to preventing, or at least mitigating, further outbreaks. And that's just one of the angles that public health has had to look at as the recovery has continued. So what else needs to be done? This week on the podcast, that's one of the questions that Dr. Mercer will answer as we look ahead, as well as behind, about the local response to COVID-19 so far. We will talk about the medical advice on masks and how it evolved over the course of the pandemic, and whether or not we're going to have to get used to them as a regular part of life from now on. We also discuss how the virus is spreading in Guelph area now, the best tips on how to avoid it as we are going out more, and how much of the regular work of public health is now being done. And finally, we will look ahead in terms of Dr. Mercer's advice about moving to stage 3, ending the local state of emergency, and how public health is preparing for that eventual return of COVID-19 in the fall and winter months. So I caught up with Dr. Mercer last week by phone from her office in Guelph. Dr. Nicola Mercer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Let me start by asking something I don't really hear you asked when you're doing all these interviews. How are you doing? How have you been through all this? And are you taking good care of yourself as you're kind of helping to guide us through the pandemic here?
Oh, well, thank you for the question. I think that for all of us who are especially public health professionals, it's a very weighty process, meaning that we feel that it's so important that we do our jobs and that we look after everybody else. So that's a big weight to shoulder, and I'm very fortunate to have amazing staff and people at work, and my husband's in healthcare too, so we've been doing our best to support each other. So it's an interesting time that we're in.
Can I ask what your husband does as a medical professional?
Oh, he's a family doctor.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, so so he's on the front lines even more so than I am.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, let's talk about the kind of what's going on with public health. As someone who kind of has for years frequently monitored the health inspection notices for restaurants and stores and things, I've noticed that that's sort of picked up lately. So how has, I guess, the regular order business of the health unit changed as we're kind of reopening the economy and the pandemic hasn't been as big a day-to-day influence on your work?
Yeah, well, that thanks for that question. So we actually, as an agency, we actually went into what we call IMS, an incident management system. It's a way that we manage an emergency. And that internally, we did that toward the end of January. And then slowly, it would normally that's a group, but a portion of our workforce. But over time, that actually grew to encompass almost every single person who works at public health had to be redeployed in order to manage this pandemic. And we are still, for the most part, redeployed. We are beginning as the economy is being reopened. Then there is a need to try to pull back people who were doing other jobs during the pandemic and put them back into their regular jobs. So you've mentioned a group which is exactly that, the inspector. So as our restaurants reopened, we needed our inspectors to begin the process of doing the inspections that they would normally do. Schools, for example, beaches. As these things open, we need to ensure that they are safe for the public to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And how has that work changed? Because, I guess is there a new checklist for when the inspectors go in? Like, it's not just a matter of making sure the utensils are clean and the food is kept in, you know, sort of proper conditions. Are your inspectors, I guess, checking on the COVID measures? Like, is there appropriate social distancing for staff and those other kind of additional management things?
Well, if they observe them, they would certainly educate and provide advice at that time. We wouldn't necessarily always see that because at a point in time when you do an inspection. But our inspectors are also the same crew that if we get a complaint about the face covering order, for example, they're the same group of people who would make a phone call and occasionally make a visit to a business in order to really determine what's going on and to provide education and awareness to the business owners.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the cases, I think, and you know, you can tell me if I'm wrong, being the medical professional of the two of us, we've done fairly well in sort of mitigating just how far the virus has spread in our community. The number is, in total cases, is 400 and something. I don't have the exact number at hand, but in terms of...
Do you want to know? It's 487.
right this minute is 487. But, you know, given the number of people that are in Guelph and the area we cover, I guess I'm looking for your assessment in terms of how you think we've done in terms of mitigating the spread. Did we exceed expectations? Did we meet expectations? Were we below expectations? You know, how are you sort of parsing that?
Well, certainly, I had no experience with the COVID-19 or a COVID epidemic, neither had anybody else actually in the world. So I think that we are basing a lot of our expectations on influenza, because that's what we see, and we see that all the time. So we sort of, that's our only comparable point, you know, in a future where, God forbid, there's another COVID pandemic, we will have this one to go back to and look at. But right now, all I have is influenza. So if I look at what's happening, and I look at what's happening in influenza, we certainly didn't see the huge peak that you're seeing in some of the American states, for example. And if you're on our website, if you go on the trends, and I usually like to see my trends you can do it by day, but by week it's actually a little bit more helpful because sometimes what is not apparent over a day is more apparent over a week. So we definitely had our peak here in our region, sort of mid to end of April, and then our numbers have dropped off. And actually, most of our numbers that we saw locally were actually as a result of outbreaks, especially in our long-term care homes. Mm-hmm. So originally, they were the first ones to get up and going was the congregate setting. So those outbreaks. But if you actually look at our community cases, and you can see that on our website under trends, if you just look at the community cases, you will see that they've actually been really remarkably consistent. So somewhere from the third week of March to the very end of March, right the way through to very recently, our numbers have been quite consistent for community cases on average on a sort of 7-day moving average. So anywhere from, you know, sort of 2-ish to 4-ish, somewhere in that range we've been tracking, and we still are tracking like that. So even though we reopened 3 weeks ago, our numbers are still, our community cases are still actually sort of very consistent. So I see that as a very good positive, that although we reopened, we know we have more social interaction, that currently we are not seeing the spike in community cases. Now, in saying that, that doesn't mean we should drop our guard. We really need to continue to be very mindful that this is a very serious virus. And I think we only have to look to our neighbor to the south to see that where they reopened quickly and where they didn't take seriously the measures that needed to occur to keep people safe, they are having some really significant transmission patterns down there that we have not seen in Ontario, because our leadership, our provincial leadership, sought and appropriately closed transmission down when they shut down a lot of our businesses.
Mm-hmm. So we're doing better. And again, correct me if I'm wrong. We shut down. We did more in terms of shutdown. We perhaps opened a bit more deliberately, a bit more slowly, only after we were sure that the spike you mentioned had passed us by. And in into this situation as well, there's continued urging of caution about physical distancing. And in the case of Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph, and a few more places now, mandatory masks.
Yeah, and I think that really there isn't a magic about how do we get out of this. It's really all of us. All of us have the control to do it. And if all of us follow the rules, then we will be able to stay in we'll get to stage 3. We'll be able to open our economy. It's really, the principles are the same as they were at the end of March, that we need to really limit our social circle. So try and, if you have that circle of 10, try and limit your bubble to those 10 people. If you are seeing others, practice rigorous physical distancing. If you are meeting a friend for coffee that's not in your bubble, do so outside and make sure that you are more than 6 feet apart. You practice good hand hygiene. If you go into any of the retail establishments, wear a mask to protect others. These sound really simple, but these very simple principles are working. We've got evidence now to show that they do work.
Yeah.
And hopefully we just have to do them until we get a vaccine or a treatment.
And you're right, too. It does sound simple, but I've noticed in sort of seeing people on social media, on TV, sort of talking about, they don't get the difference of between, hanging out with people outside, hanging out with people inside, and then when you are outside, hanging out with people in those tight clusters. We saw in that one Toronto Park, on the beaches in Wasaga, and maybe hanging out with one person at a coffee table on a patio. It's there's a simplicity to your advice, right? But there's I guess there's some. How people are interpreting those rules is where we're seeing the complications.
I think if we had a disease where people broke out in a rash or spots or something, a day before they became infectious, we wouldn't have this challenge, because we would be able to know, you've got the disease and therefore you need to go into isolation before you infect anybody. But this disease isn't like that. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We do know that there are people with very mild symptoms who are what we call pre-symptomatic. They're going to get symptoms, but maybe tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Or some people are asymptomatic, and they can give it to you. So we now have several examples in the States of really tragic examples. One's a birthday party, another was a barbecue, where one person in an indoor environment infected almost everybody who was present in that indoor environment. And many were hospitalized, some, and some are critical. So it is really nothing we just have to be careful. Your friend may not know that they're infected, and they may unwittingly give it to you. And you may give it to them, or your parents, or your loved ones, or your kids. So you really have to be very mindful that it's a respiratory disease. Mm. Nobody means to give it to somebody.
Right.
But people just don't know that they actually have the virus. So they get too close. My breathing in a room that we are working together in as coworkers, just breathing, maybe talking, having a little chit-chat, could be enough to affect the person in my office.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't even touched them.
Right. Right. Depending on how small the office is and how closely everyone sits together.
Yes. And if there's good circulation, if the door's closed, how long we spend together. So I continue to say, and also when I'm chatting with people or business leaders, to say, if your employees do not need to work in the office or could work less in the office because they do most of their work remotely, then they should work remotely.
Mm-hmm.
They should, in order to keep them safe and to decrease the number of social interactions that we have in the workplace, which often I know is difficult. And sometimes for the mental health of people, sometimes you have to bring them into the workplace. If you live alone and you work alone, that can be a very difficult mental health environment. So
Right. We
have to take everything into context. But in general, if you can limit your social circle, it will make a difference.
And would I be correct in assuming that, you know, that advice goes double for days like today, where it is really, really hot outside? People perhaps seek the comfort of their air-conditioned office or home, where all the doors and windows are closed and the same air is recirculating around and around and around.
Well, I think if they're by them, like if they're in their own social circle,
right?
But what we have seen is that if one individual gets COVID-19 in a family or in a home environment, that it is very likely that there are remainder of the people in that home will get it, because it is quite infectious. It's not completely impossible, but it does require very rigorous isolation techniques on the part of the individual who is ill.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most part, as you would expect, if you live in a home with others, everybody eventually shares the same virus.
Right. I have a weird question, or it's going to at least sound weird, but as you mentioned, we still have, you know, maybe four or five people getting COVID every day, or, you know, every other day, it's another four or five different people. How does one get COVID-19 in Wellington, Dufferin, and Guelph right now?
Well, it's a great question. It's a really good question. So most of the time when we find a case that's not connected to anybody else, they have no idea where they got it from,
mm-hmm.
which tells me that there's somebody else out in our community who has COVID who didn't know they had it, which leads me back to the first, what we were talking about earlier, that some people who have very, very mild symptoms or no symptoms can give you the disease. So that is why we always have to practice really carefully. It doesn't matter with whether it's your family, because you always think your family are safe or your coworkers safe. I know them. I like them.
Right.
But anybody could be incubating the COVID-19 virus. So when we ask people, so who's been around? Anybody been sick? And sometimes we find that they have been around somebody who's ill, and we find another case of COVID-19. But also, it is quite frequent that we have no idea where this person got it from, which tells you that there are other people in our community who have it and haven't been diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. So they may have just past the wrong person at the wrong time in the supermarket? And
I think it's truthfully that is not likely the the way people get it.
Right.
Like just walking past somebody on the sidewalk or on in a supermarket, you're very unlikely, especially nowadays, you're going to be wearing a face covering, but you're very unlikely to get COVID-19 that way. Again, touching surfaces. We try to keep our hands clean, but touching surfaces is a way you can get COVID-19, but it is not the most likely way you get it. The most common way is having a conversation or just being close to somebody within that, you know, having a little chat maybe in a corridor at work, or you go and visit your friends or family you haven't seen in a long time, and you do so in an indoor environment.
It's an important distinction. I guess along with that too, and just so we can put it on the record, the health units traced no cases of COVID back to the big Black Lives Matter protest that happened on June the 6th.
We have no cases that are directly linked to that. I mean, could I say for sure that there was no cases? No. But that protest, the organizers were very thoughtful and consulted with public health and prior to the event. So it was done so in a way. It was outdoors, people were wearing masks, and people were practicing some level of physical distancing.
I think that brings me to a part of the discussion I really wanted to have, which is I think one of the interesting things about covering COVID as a reporter, as an observer, just generally, is that we're seeing the scientific process happen in real time because COVID is a new disease. And one of the interesting facets of that, and you know, maybe one of the difficult public health, you know, things to overcome, regulatorily speaking, if that's a word, but the condition of masks, and how at the beginning we had Dr. Tam in Ottawa saying she wasn't sure it was helpful, and then we come to a few months later, and we are seeing the general advice being that, you know, wearing masks out in public is something we should be doing. Can you explain how that insight into the virus evolved over time, and maybe how we got to your decision about issuing the public health regulation?
Yeah, that's good, and I think it truly does showcase how, as knowledge evolves, we must change our decisions as we go along. So, from the time that we became aware of this virus and the first cases appeared, we needed to, and that was back on December 31st when we sort of published the first report. We've learned a lot. We've learned a ton about this particular virus, but you know what? There's still lots that we need to learn, in particular about its transmission and how it affects people, and why some people are very, very sick and other people don't even know they have it. So there's lots and lots of questions that we need to understand about this virus moving forward. And one of the things that we is evolving in our knowledge is about really the transmission. If you look at masks, like I mentioned before about a pandemic, the only pandemic, if you ask me, was I happy how it turned out, the only pandemics I can compare it to are influenza pandemics, because we haven't had a coronavirus pandemic in my experience or my understanding of the literature to go back and review. So if we are looking at mask use, what we've all done and what the research has done is you have to go back and look at mask use in influenza, because we didn't have a mask use in COVID studies to really look at initially. And there were significant shortages. And remember also that as we went into this, many people were staying home. People were home and in their own units. So you don't need to wear a mask if you're in your own home and you're staying home and you're well. But I do have to admit that as we've learned more about the virus, our understanding of how it's transmitted has changed. So we were, we did not know that asymptomatic people could shed the virus, for example, or asymptomatic people. Most diseases, people are symptomatic when they're spreading the virus. Not all, but quite a few are. We didn't even know whether it was 1 or 2 days before you had symptoms. Were you infectious? So little questions like that are really important when it comes to transmission of the virus. So as we've learned more, asked more questions, and to be quite frank, there is still a lot we don't know, even about mask use. But the evidence appears, again, there is no randomized double-blind controlled study on this, but the evidence is looking like, as a population, if we all wear masks, that it reduces overall transmission and overall the burden of illness. So what it means is that masks aren't perfect. My mask protects you, your mask protects me. Although not perfectly, but by wearing a mask and everybody wearing a mask, we decrease some transmission. So as a population, we've done better than if nobody was wearing a mask. That is what the evidence is appearing to say. But again, we await, and I know there will be papers out next week and the week after. And we, people really want to know, really want to understand that most of the papers that look at mask wearing, for example, and the word mask, are because they're looking at surgical masks or N95 masks.
Right.
Those are hospital grade. Those are hospital masks. Most of us are not wearing hospital masks when we go out. We're wearing cloth masks or homemade masks. So those are very difficult to study because my cloth mask may work differently than your cloth mask.
Right.
So again, that's a variable that is difficult to control for. So we don't have, the evidence is insufficient right now to make a broad statement, but there is an increasing amount of evidence that would suggest that it has a population level benefit.
It's interesting too that, you know, you're talking about science is built on precedent. You're trying to go back in time to look at how something similar to COVID was handled. When that comes to masks, though, wearing masks as kind of a habit is a new phenomenon in North America, not so much in Asia,
yeah.
Where, you know, it is kind of a habit and is widely seen. And, of course, a lot of Asian people bring that to North America, and by and large, until recently, we found that behavior rather strange. But you know, how wide is, I guess, the net? Does the research cast in terms of, like, has this shown? Are people in Asian countries less prone to influenza and the common cold because they already have that culture in place of wearing the mask?
That's a good question, and certainly in a lot of these cultures, my wearing a mask is a sign of respect to you.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't always have influenza. I'm not feeling well, for example, so I will wear a mask out of respect for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in North American culture, we're more, it's a little bit different. We're wearing a mask hoping to protect ourselves, whereas a mask use really is a way of protecting others, and if we're all masked, then we're all protecting each other. But certainly, in Asian cultures, they have handled this pandemic quite differently, with results that I think for many countries have been, given the infectiousness of the Asian, and given that a lot of those Asian countries saw this pandemic first, right? So whether you were in China or South Korea or Japan, you were actually getting some of the earliest cases in the world. So that gave you less time to be prepared for those cases.
Right.
So I would say that they, as a sort of an overall statement, they have done well in general, given those variables. I think if you look at a society that's been very resistant to wearing a mask, or public health interventions. The United States has had and continues to have very different outcomes that are very troubling and worrying for those of us in public health, because their second wave, which it looks like they're having right now, will have a much higher peak than the first wave, which should be a lesson for those of us in Canada to say that we didn't have the first wave peak. Doesn't mean we couldn't have a high peak for the second wave. I believe that Ontarians and Canadians are much more cohesive as a society to practice the measures that are needed to protect everyone.
We also have 1/10 the population, too.
Well, we do, but we do have a large urban area, like Toronto, for example.
Sure.
That is the state that's created many urban areas in the United States. So that's really a test for our societal public health measures that we all practice.
Mm-hmm.
Does have a huge benefit.
Mm-hmm. I do want to look a bit into the future before we run out of time. In terms of the fall, I imagine you and your staff are looking towards when, and you can correct me on that, but what the fall might look like in terms of measures we can take to make sure we don't have to have another shutdown in the fall. You know, what's the current planning behind a second wave?
Yeah, a great question. And our board meeting on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, we'll have a report asking that exact question. So we don't have a crystal ball. We know that there's a number of possibilities that could occur. And similar to when the pandemic hit Ontario, we didn't know how bad it was going to be, because we didn't know what burden of coronavirus is actually already circulating in our communities when we shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And how much public health measures were going to be enforced or implemented, and how much provincial support there was going to be for those measures. But based on all that, we did extremely well compared to many other areas of similar geography. So going into the fall, I think that Ontarians, and certainly in my area, I think we recognize the importance of these measures. I know that there have been, there have been the odd party that's happened. But we need to continually be very vigilant in trying to help people to understand that we're not trying to keep everyone safe. When we get workplace outbreaks such as the spa in Kingston, that requires a lot of work on the part of public health staff to find everyone, isolate everyone, and to prevent it from going any further. Because that still has the potential to be very problematic. If 500 people infected and each person infects one or more other people, it quickly can grow quite large if you don't catch it really early.
My next question, and maybe I'll have to make it my last question, is when you are thinking about, or when you're consulting on when stage three of the reopening might begin, or even maybe after that, in terms of looking ahead to the conditions by which you might advise Mayor Guthrie that it could be time to lift the state of emergency, what are the considerations? What are the things on sort of your checklist to give that advice, and in terms of when do we start stage three, when do we end the state of emergency?
Yeah, well, the entering stage three, I think that will occur in the not too distant future, because we are doing a very good job of keeping our reproductive number low, and it is really important to open our economy. Many people, the lack of income can be directly linked to poor health. So we do need to try and get people back to work and employed in a manner that's safe. So that's partly why I continue to support that we would have masks in indoor environments, and to continue to have those measures in place that will keep people safe and keep people working. And those are important. The schools are going to be a very, very interesting situation. Again, we don't have the data or the literature. So we're all doing it for the first time, using the best scientific evidence that we can and the best public health measures that we can.
Mm-hmm. Is that frustrating for you? Because, you know, how often in a medical career do you deal with the real unknown? I mean, unless that's your sort of field of expertise and you're in, you know, virology and developing diseases and, you know, vaccines for those diseases. In public health, you're mostly dealing with known quantities. But you and so many other public health officials in Canada have had to sail into the unknown for months now. And, you know, that how frustrating is that?
Well, who would have predicted, any of us, back at Christmas, that this would be 2020, right?
Right.
It really makes you realize how powerful the virus is in changing, not just even one area, but or even one country, but the entire world's trajectory. Is really quite humbling. Situation, and we do need to just, and I'm also overwhelmed by the speed at which the scientific community is working collaboratively and together. This will be, when we have a vaccine, and I believe we will get a vaccine, but this will be the fastest development of a new virus to vaccine that historically will have ever occurred. And that just tells you how many people, how many researchers, how many truly, truly brilliant minds are working on this across the world.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Sure.
So, Dr. Mercer, thank you so much for your time and expertise. It is really appreciated. And since we all know that this is far from over, and it's just been great to get all this insight from you today. So, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. So, stay safe.
And once again, that was Dr. Nicola Mercer. There is a Board of Health meeting today at 3 p.m. if you are listening to this on Wednesday. And at that meeting, there will be an update on the local battle against COVID-19 from that public health perspective. The City Council update is next Wednesday, and that will be a regular council meeting starting at 2 p.m. As for all the other public health notices regarding COVID-19 or any other public health matter, you can, of course, visit Wellington Dufferin Guelph Public Health at their website at wdgpublichealth.ca. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is usually recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, you can go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. You can reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can find Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.